Coming up on this In Contrast special, the third of seven episodes examining American media. I'm Ilan Stavans.
And I'm Ray Suarez.
In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Emotion, reason and emotion, which trumps which? And of course, the word here in the middle is not casual. The current president is often about this raw emotional aspect of being loved, being celebrated, being idolized, and everybody who falls out of that circle or series of concentric circles is an enemy. He who doesn't love me is against me. Sounds like Fidel Castro or Mussolini or Stalin. On the other hand, I have something that makes me cringe when I am exposed to a certain slice of the American media that overemphasizes emotion in a different perspective. I want to give you, Ray Suarez, one example. It is when there is a survivor of a train wreck or a capsized ship or a car accident, and the reporter that comes and approaches that individual asks, what do you feel right now? What does it feel to have survived? What do you feel when you are all covered with blood or your bones are broken or you are in an ambulance? What do you feel? What kind of question is it? It seems to me there's something obscene about it. We are putting a microphone into somebody who has undergone a tragic circumstance, and we are stressing that emotional side. And so I think to myself, what is it that we, the recipients of that news clip, are meant to receive? What do we want to hear that if we were in such a crash, we would feel the same thing? Are we supposed to have empathy? And that word, empathy, is to me the trap. It seems that there is so much that the American media wants to create as empathetic. We want to have these characters in front of you that you will feel like. Not that you will think like, but that you will feel like. Because we're all in this group together feeling the same things.
The modern news business was built on the idea, and since I lived in the belly of the beast for decades, I can tell you, and you have to believe me, that how people feel was a very important part of the currency that we gathered, accumulated, and spent as storytelling entities. If we just said, this train derailed, this is why it derailed, this is what happened when it derailed, our coverage would be dismissed as bloodless, informative, yes, but unexciting. What we want to do, ideally, or so I was told by my bosses year after year, was take someone to the place and give them a flavor of what it was like to be there. If it smelled of burning rubber or burning electrical insulation, if the sounds of in the air were of people screaming and crying and wailing when they realized that people that they loved were injured in the crash, when we could capture somebody and get them to talk to us for a few minutes, it's one of the most horrible parts of the job, I always found as a reporter, to talk to them in a way that was sympathetic, but also elicit information from them and not be thought a ghoul. It is, in some levels, one of the worst aspects of what the news business has come to be, as emotion has totally, in a tsunami, crashed like a wave over the more who, what, when, where, why, how parts of what we exist as an institution to do. Emotion has become a really big part of the storytelling. To get somebody to cry on air, to get somebody to look as stricken as they are. One time, after someone from the Chicago area was killed somewhere else by a murderer, they were on the road, they were living somewhere else, and they were killed, And an assignment editor sent me over to somebody's house to talk to their family. The father of the dead young adult opened the door and said, "Oh, you, what do you expect me to say?" And at that moment, I felt like such a heel, because really, what was I there for? There was nothing that I could tell the audience in Chicago that would help them understand their world better. It was just a terrible, unfortunate thing that the child of this family, who was now somewhere else in the country, was killed under terrible circumstances, and the father distilled my misgivings at that moment at the door when he looked at me and said, "Oh, you," because he knew me from television, and said, "What do you expect me to say?" Because really, there was nothing to say. So I said, "I'm sorry about your daughter." He slammed the door in my face, and I walked back to the car.
I remember during the coverage of 9/11 that I thought a number of times that we had finally reached ground zero, not because of what the terrorists did to the World Trade Center or the Pentagon or any other aspect of American culture, but that we had really reached ground zero in the globalism that had been much in the discourse, academic, political, economic, all of us hooked into the very same media at the very same time. This very concept we were discussing in the previous episode, the Balkanization or the fragmentation of American media, during the first 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 of the coverage, everybody seemed to be hooked to the television. And there was a therapeutic quality to it. We were so traumatized by what had happened. It was so deep, so transformative, that in the act and maybe in the art of watching, we were hoping to share the pain with others, explain it to ourselves, and come to grips with this dramatic transformation, the before 9/11 and the after 9/11. And that therapeutic aspect seemed to me to have reached its climax, ground zero, both as the very bottom or the very top. Because what the American media in general, here talking about this country, does so shamelessly is to play with those emotional sides and to turn itself into a shrink, to try to help the rest of us cope with our endless problems, opioid, alcohol, child domestic abuse, incapacity to have normal relationships, excess of all types, through a series of videos or news clips that are going to solve our challenges. And that is incredibly deceitful. That is hitting the concept of the rawest and most primitive, the crudest and cruelest of emotions, and pretend that we will feel better, if anything, at least in the immediate future. The long-term future, that's another story, but maybe we'll be hooked to the television and the radio still.
Well, look, as someone who spent the first 2 weeks after the jets crashed in and around Ground Zero, even going with search and rescue dogs into the wreckage underneath the World Trade Towers after they went down, I can tell you that a lot of the reporters working on the scene were trying to be careful. Yes, we were inviting people to find a doorway into this almost inconceivable scale of tragedy. We were trying to cover a serious international crime, an attack on the United States, and a peculiar human drama that illustrated something about the modern world city. So I stood with a young woman in her late 20s from Central America, whose husband, the father of her children, worked in the kitchen at the World Trade Center restaurant at the top of one of the towers. Someone who had grown up in a rural village in Central America, come to New York as a teenager, and now worked in the kitchen at Windows on the World, and died in an international terror incident meant to strike at American power, meant to strike at American prosperity, meant to strike at American potency from yet another place in the world. So if he had stayed in Guatemala, he'd still be alive. But instead, he took his chance, like millions of other people have, and became an American, and his kids were U.S. citizens. And his wife had no idea whether he got out, whether he was in a hospital. We were at St. Vincent's Hospital in Lower Manhattan. She had no idea whether the people who were taken injured from the towers were conscious, able to speak, beyond recognition, in a coma. It was only another day before we found that almost nobody had been taken injured from the scene. So everybody who was in the buildings died, period. But at that moment, a lot of different things were wrapped up in this one story. The inability to find things out after a terrible event. The poignancy of this young woman beginning to contemplate the possibility that her husband had been killed. The way that New Yorkers who come to the world from every place on the world become New Yorkers just by being there, that amazing act. While I was standing in front of St. Vincent's Hospital with this woman, ashes and stationery from the World Trade Center were landing on my parents' lawn across the bay in Brooklyn, on the lawn of their house. It was a remarkable time. It was fully problematic for all the reasons you suggest, yet at the same time offered possibilities for somebody in Iowa, somebody in Mississippi, somebody in Florida to become part of this story in a way that they couldn't otherwise. If they've never been to New York, if they had never seen the buildings, if they were far from a place that would ever be on a terrorist target list, they were part of this because they were Americans, but they weren't part of it because they really had no well-founded fear of Osama bin Laden targeting Council Bluffs, Iowa. So we were in this amazing moment where, yes, we were all drawn together as Americans, and yet still strangers to each other and foreigners to each other. I wondered at the time, and I still do, how much someone in St. Louis could identify with that Guatemalan short order cook at Windows on the World. Could they share in that moment of that tragedy a humanity that belonged to both of them and a nationality and an identity that belonged to both of them?
I think there is something beautiful and dangerous in what you're saying. Beautiful because you were performing your role as journalist in this moment and you found this story. One eternal question that I have as a writer and as a teacher and as a journalist when I become one, when I put the hat of one, is what is a story? When does a story begin? When does a story end? How does one identify a story and how does one tell that story in a way that is truthful to the story itself, doesn't betray it? And you found one. Of course, the story found you too. You were part of the larger narrative. And the larger narrative is one that is, in my view, defined by forces far beyond our own control. We don't only experience life as individuals, we experience life through the culture, and that is the lens, the prism that defines us. So the question to me is, how do we experience tragedy? To what extent our politicians, and we say this as historians or as readers of the past, have used tragedy in order to make countries, nations, collectivities come together? We became more American. I remember the tension within me saying, I became part of this country. I empathize it. I am saturated by the amount of flags that I'm seeing. They are all over, from my neighborhood to the cars that are just passing the street to everywhere I go when I take a plane or a walk. Do you need to put all those American flags in America where everybody knows what they are? Have we become tourists of our own country, stressing this aspect? There is a philosopher of the Renaissance that I admire thoroughly because of his hyper-intellectualism, and that is Baruch Spinoza. he was a Jew, the way I am, often in tension with his community. And ultimately, there was a harem, that is, an expulsion of a Spinoza of the community because they deemed him dangerous in his philosophical disquisitions on what God is and is not. One of the books that Spinoza wrote that I find absolutely enthralling is called Ethics. It's a mathematical or almost geometrical book. And an aspect of Spinoza's work that I like in particular is an attempt that he has of categorizing the human emotions. Just think of it. How many emotions are there? Do we have words for all these emotions? Can we really categorize them? I'm often struck by the fact that in English, the word love is used for so many different feelings. The love of a parent to a child, the romantic love between two individuals, the love of nature, the love of God, the love of country, the love of oneself, self-love. Are all this really love? Is what I feel of myself and to myself the same thing that I feel to my mother and that I have felt throughout my mother for 50 years? Or those emotions different, and have they transitioned into different varieties? But the only thing that we have is that four-letter word, love, that ought to express the emotion that connects us. I don't think that any individual would come up with a list of emotions. It had to be a Dutch Jew isolated from his community, both human and detached from the human aspect, who could think that that would become an intellectual subject of study. I think of this because I think that we live in a kind of confusing blender of emotions, roller coaster, where love and hate are often presented to us as two sides of the same cone. I have trouble distinguishing between varieties of love. Mixing it with hate is complicated. And some will say one emotion is the absence of the other one. We often hear that pain is the absence of joy, or joy is the absence of pain. Not quite equal. But I don't think that 9/11 would have been experienced the same way were the Greeks the ones that had been hit, or the Romans, or any other empire. We, a very reserved people that, compared to others, you and I come from Hispanic, Latino backgrounds, and we know that in our culture, emotions spill over. The telenovela is the best example. There's music in the background all the time, and everybody is expressing surprise by just finding out that there's an illegitimate child, or that somebody's having an affair with somebody else, and the face is of shock and disbelief. A country that is contained, that is self-assured, saw itself almost naked emotionally in that 9/11 period. And it was a kind of fiesta of raw emotions that I think should be seen differently from the very witness role that you had right there as a participant to the almost 20 years later that we have that can look at it with some perspective.
What's the rave that a news person is looking for? If your bosses said, I learned something and you made me feel something, you are golden. If you come away from coverage of a story and they say, boy, you didn't cheat the story, so you told me what happened, but you also made me feel something, or you've earned your keep, you've saved yourself for another contract, you've kept your job. And it's not just in terms of tragedy. Emotion is sometimes the door that people use to gain understanding of issues, of challenges, of conflicts in society, in a way that if you just brought them the facts of the matter, they wouldn't get. I used to wrestle with this all the time as a reporter. Finally, I just figured, I'm not going to change people. I'm not going to change the business all by myself. So let me try to steer a course that feels right to me, gives them enough of what they want in making me feel something, and yet still does an honest job of telling people what was at stake, what was going on. And I was very eyes open about what I was up to day in and day out as a reporter. But I also knew that if I told people how many children died in Tanzania of malaria, that's one kind of thing. It's me standing in an identifiably African setting saying this many thousand children from this country that I'm in die from malaria. It's totally another thing to be with a young mother who's got a malaria-infected baby in her arms, who's running a spiking fever, crying uncontrollably, and the woman is telling you what it's like to have a baby with malaria. They both are helping you transmit a certain set of facts, but yes, I got to make you feel something if I also want you to learn something. And I could have tried to defeat that impulse in the way that American media does its work, or I could have just tried to have a career. And I'm not telling you this, Ilan, in a way that's defensive. I'm just trying to say how I squared that circle for myself. I knew I had to do a certain amount of one in order to accomplish what I was there to accomplish with the other.
Which is fascinating because you have been in the battlefield, so to speak, that is in the pursuit of that story, and you know what it means to fit or not fit inside and how to deliver it. But I think it's wrong. I think that the tyranny of emotion in the delivery of stories in American media is excessive and unneeded. And I think that it has pushed the country over the edge. I think to some extent, it is the result of the type of politics that we have, where we have to undress every politician that is in front of us to see their sins and make them expiate in front of us. I think that we have lost track of what matters. And I'm going to use two elements here. And I can say that, of course, from the comfort of not having been the reporter, as I'm sure you're going to criticize me in other parts later on, or you have already, because it's much easier to be an observer than to be right there in the moment when the story is taking place. The other side of emotion is reason, or is it? We posit them as antagonists or this equation. I'm not sure, because we have been shrewd enough to understand that there are different types of reason, that one can have an emotional type of reason or one can have a very mathematical type of reason, in that in order to survive, to assimilate, to engage in the world, reason cannot be seen in a single-sided, single-faceted way. It needs to be flexible. It needs to be plastic. It needs to be engaged. So I'm not sure. I think there's reason in emotion and there's emotion in reason. At the same time, there is this easy thought that numbers, data, larger doses of information are rational, in the feeling that one will get, the editor will tell you, you will, as a reporter, will tell the editor, that is what I want you to bring to me and you will get your next contract. I want the audience to feel something. But in saying, Ray, that so many children have died in Ethiopia out of hunger, by putting a number to the amount of children, you had these two examples, the individual child that is in front of you, where you can interview the mother or you can interview the doctor or you see that individual case in context, and then you put it in the larger context, there are 6,000 cases today that have broken. It makes us feel that because there are 6,000 cases, the emotional dimension of a particular story is bigger. But we all know very well that nobody suffers in the same way, and that one person's suffering is different to somebody else's suffering. We quantify emotions as if they were quantifiable, whereas emotions are actually the least quantifiable. And I'm saying this in the context of Spinoza trying to organize them too. So I want to throw that to you, but I want to throw another element here. And that is that though all reporters are or ought to be equal, not all reporters are equal. And reporters come from different cultures, and there are reporters that are more disposed or predisposed to a particular aspect of a story. Of course, that has to go through a filter of editors and packaging. But it is important to keep in mind as we think of diversifying, hopefully, American media, that immigrants in this give and take that you were talking about, we become Americans and America becomes us. There is maybe a warming of American culture as a result of the different types of immigrants that are coming that are not from Europe, or that are not from certain parts of the world that have been seen as cold, stereotypically. And does that mean that the stories are going to become even more emotional? Or because we are mindful of this, we can restrain ourselves?
Well, you put aside to a certain degree who you are and where you're from and what you're like as an individual when you submit to the folkways, to the model of American-style storytelling. And there have been stories that I've put on the air that in the days following, I've gotten letters from listeners saying that I'm too cold-blooded and one saying I'm too manipulative about the same story. So I'm under no illusions about what the audience wants. Anytime I talk into a microphone or go on camera, I work for a very large number of bosses, both the one that I can see, who has some role in me getting my paycheck, and the ones that I can't see in their millions, who look at the product of my work and decide whether or not it's worthy. My rule about this is that people sit down to consume media in a constant state of identification. So they watch all these impressions roll by, and they're constantly saying to themselves, me, not me. Me, not me. This person's like me. This aspect of this person's life is like my life. This is not like my life. And they're buying in and dropping out and buying in and dropping out in a constant, constant flow. If it's too much dropping out and not enough buying in, you are going to have a problem keeping your audience. And I realize that that is manipulative. And for that, I retroactively plead guilty, and I'm sorry to anyone who has felt that way. We call it the news business in part because it's a business with ads and revenue and the need to raise money to pay for the things we do. I wasn't standing in a village in Tanzania at a malaria clinic for free. I had to get there somehow, and my cameraman had to get there, and the camera had to be bought, and then the footage had to be edited, and all those things that happen. It is a business. And while I accept your critique and I understand exactly what you're getting at, we have this rough master of an audience that the news business is convinced if we are too rational, will abandon us. And at a time when people are seizing on ideas and making them their own in a way that's more emotional than ever before, choosing up sides in their own head about who they believe and who they don't believe based on emotion more than ever before. There were people who didn't like, just to pick a name out of a hat, John Kerry, and they would listen to him explain a challenge and make fun of him. He wasn't wrong. He wasn't incorrect. He wasn't mistaken in any way about the nature of the challenge, but they didn't like him. So they don't listen to a thing he says. They find him off-putting, and they find his diagnosis off-putting. And right now, we have, on the flip side of that coin, a president who in many ways displays day after day imperfect knowledge of the nature of the challenge and is applauded by huge audiences because in that me, not me dichotomy, he gets enough buy-in so that a lot of the people who are cheering don't even care if that's a slightly inaccurate description of the law that he's trying to change. It doesn't matter. And there, emotion is being lifted over rationality in a way that we really do have to worry about.
Business, no doubt, maybe also addiction. We are all addicts in one way or another. Some medical, that is anatomical, I'm using this as a metaphor too, and others in psychological ways. And there is the view that the 24/7 news cycle, in order to keep this emotional connection, this buy-in or retreat that you're talking about, needs the addiction. If we don't feed the addict, then who are we? Let's talk about it next time. Let us know what you think about this In Contrast special. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@npr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. To find out more about all of our In Contrast programs, visit our website at npr.net/incontrast. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans.
And I'm Ray Suarez. Thank you for listening.
In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.